He is a writer-director responsible for films like Tin Cup, White Men Can't Jump, Bull Durham, Cobb, Blaze, and he's the author of a terrific new book called The Church of Baseball, The Making of Bull Durham, Home Runs, Bad Calls, Crazy Fights, Big Swings, and a Hit. Ron Shelton, welcome to Downtown.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. I'm so tempted. I'm just going to say it. I'm sure the book is good. I'm only on page 40, maybe 35.
Oh, it's very good. There's 205 more pages.
No, I was dropping the Anthony Michael Hall quote. Oh,
yeah. Well, no. At least you got there on the first meeting.
I read the whole book, and it was fantastic. Of course, love the movie, but the book is such a fascinating story. And Bull Durham was such an unlikely hit. A first-time director, no, at the time, real proven box office stars. It was a sports movie. It was a sports movie without the big game or the big hit. And as you point out, didn't really even have a third act.
Yeah. And, you know, the two characters you're following, Crash Davis and Nuke LaLoosh, Kevin Costner and Tim Robbins, they aren't even with the team at the end of the movie. And we have no idea what happened to the team. So not only is there no big game, there's not even a team.
Now, you've said you're not a guy who spends a lot of time looking backwards, but you mentioned that it was an incident in Durham for the 30th anniversary when you met a couple of youngsters, and that helped inspire you to write this book.
I did. That was about 4 years ago, and they had Bull Durham Night, and it was a big deal because the whole town credits the movie with turning it around from a dumpy little boarded-up A-ball town to a really happening place in a AAA ballpark. And I was asked by a couple. The couple said, we moved to Durham because of the movie, which seemed a little crazy to me. And would you mind taking a picture with us and our two boys? And I said, of course. This was before the game. So as I'm posing, I turn to the 10-year-old and I say, what's your name? He said, my name's Crash. And I looked at his younger brother and says, I'm afraid to ask. And he said, yep, I'm Nuke. I thought, I better write a book because this movie's not going away.
Well, let's talk about your backstory, because you include that in the book as well. You grew up in a very strict religious family, no TV, no movies, and it was only the chance to see hometown hero Eddie Matthews in, I think, game 4 of the 57 World Series that led your family to get your first television.
Yeah, I don't think my family was that strict. It was a very old-fashioned, church-going family. It was also very open-minded about the arts. It was a family that fought for civil rights and minority rights in every way. So, you know, Republicans used to be different. And it was the Republican Party I grew up with, to be honest, which is unrecognizable at the moment.
Right.
But it was also a loving family, but yeah, it was very old-fashioned. No TV, no drinking, no cursing. And then when Eddie Matthews, it's detailed in the book, Eddie Matthews, we skipped church to watch the fourth game of the World Series, and Eddie Matthews hit a home run to win the game for the Braves, who went on to win the World Series. And I just noticed my father started going to church a little less after Eddie liberated us.
As a young man, once you started watching movies, you mentioned in the book that The Hustler was one of your favorites. Who could imagine, as you sat in a movie theater as a young guy watching The Hustler, that one day you'd have a chance to direct Paul Newman?
Never. I was never intended to be even a writer. But after baseball, I just was writing and trying to sell short stories, and I loved movies, and just kept writing screenplays at night, trying to figure it out. Never took a class, never went to film school, and, you know, kicked the doors down finally, and discovered that I loved everything about it. I loved working with actors. I loved directing. And I think my preparation as a professional athlete was great. Was great preparation. It applied to everything, you know. You got to be prepared. You got to not get too high on a good day, not to get low on a bad day. And I think playing all those bus rides helped me as a director.
Now, you mentioned that as a student athlete in college, that's when you first had the realization that most sports movies just weren't that good and didn't get the sports part right.
that was the big thing. Every sports movie seems to end with a grand slam in the bottom of the ninth to win a World Series, or a half-court hook shot, you know, at the NBA Finals, or something, you know, Hail Mary that gets caught. And we know that those are aberrant. Those are rare, rare things. And they never rarely happen in a big game anyway. They usually happen in the third game of the season of two high schools in Nebraska. So that was the first thing. The second thing was that the actors were never very good athletes. And also, they never get, sports movies don't get the detail and the nuance. They're all like made by people who are fans, but not actually players.
You got signed by the Orioles and joined their organization. I feel like, Ron, we could do a whole show just on Joe Altobelli and Steve Dalkowski.
Yeah, I talk about them a lot in the book. Joe was a career AAA player who had a cup of coffee in the big leagues and was starting all over as a manager in his late 30s when I signed. I was on his first team in the Appalachian League out of California. I went to Bluefield, West Virginia. And then through my career in the minors, I kind of kept moving up with Joe, who later managed a World Series championship Baltimore team. But when we got to AAA, along the way, I was learning Steve Dalkowski stories, because Dalkowski is a legendary pitcher in the minor leagues who never got to the majors. Most say the hardest thrower who ever lived, and also sadly an alcoholic from New Britain, Connecticut, by the way, and ended up working as a migrant farm worker. I mean, really sad story. And I wrote many, many articles about him. But he ended up rooming 10 years to get to AAA, and they roomed him with Joe Altobelli so that Joe would mature him. And I said, "Joe, what was it like?" And he said, "I never saw him all year. I roomed with his suitcase," which is a famous line. But that was the idea for the new crash relationship.
There was a little Steve Dalkowski in there, but also a little bit of a guy that you played with in the Orioles system, Mike Ferraro, right?
Mike Ferraro, yeah. I mean, I played with Mike. I wasn't close to Mike, but I had great admiration for Mike. He was a upstate New York guy, but he was an all-star third baseman many years in the International League, AAA. His insurance for the major league third baseman, mm-hmm. whether it was Brooks Robinson or Greg Nettles or whoever. And it was really unfair to him that he instead of being on a big league roster, he was insurance. And he's not like Crash Davis exactly, but I knew a lot of guys whose professionalism I really admired, like Mike.
We're talking with Ron Shelton. His book is called The Church of Baseball, of the Making of Bull Durham. You'd had some success as a writer with, an underappreciated film, Under Fire. I love the movie. We've had Joanna Cassidy on the show. That was a terrific film.
Thank you. And it was my film school, because I got to direct second unit and be on all stages of planning and editing. And that was film school in one movie. And I appreciate it. I'm very proud of that movie.
Now, they always say write what you know, and you certainly knew the life of a minor leaguer. When it came to Bull Durham, there's so many wonderful stories in the book. I loved your pitch to Tom Mount for the film that you encapsulated in just five words.
Lysistrata in the minor leagues. That was my pitch.
And that was enough to hook him.
Tom was the only guy that knew that Lysistrata was a legendary Greek played by Aristophanes. It was a satire, women withholding their sexual favors from the men until they stop going to war, which becomes kind of a gag in the middle of the second act of my story. And he owned the pieces of minor league teams. And so he knew the infield fly rule in Greek comedy. So that's a rare bird in Hollywood.
We learn in the book that there was a real Lawrence Crash Davis, and it sounds like he was really a terrific person.
I got the name for Crash Davis out of an old Carolina League record book. And I noticed he'd hit for some guy. I just thought Crash Davis was the best name. I wish it was my name. Right now, I wish it was my name. And hey, Crash, get over here, And he hit 50 doubles in 1947. And I assumed he was long gone, because nobody lives in the town they end their minor league career. I mean, I don't live in Rochester. You go home or wherever your new home is. And the day before we started shooting, he basically called and said, "Hi, this is Crash Davis. What are you making a movie about me for?" because his daughters and granddaughters had seen a Kevin Costner movie written about in the paper about to be shot. So he came to the set, let me use his name, and we became friends. I later put him in Cobb. He played the yellow lion as Wahoo Sam Crawford, right. I think.
And there was a real Ebby Calvin, but he was a LaRouche.
He was a waiter at a Radisson in Columbia, South Carolina. And I just stole his name and changed LaRouche to LaLouche.
And you explained that Annie is really an amalgamation of a number of women you knew in the 60s that had gone on their own spiritual journeys.
Yeah, I mean, mostly she's a work of the imagination, but you know, in the 60s, where everybody, men and women, were on searching and worshiping all the religions, looking for one that worked, and trying, you know, crystals and Eastern religion and reading Alan Watts and all that. Now it's 20 years later. What are these people doing? I have affection for that group of people because it was when I was in the 60s, it was when I was in formative years and teenager and turning 20 and playing baseball and the war in Vietnam. I mean, it was a terribly complicated time in America. And it lives intensely in most people who were young and lived through it.
I was fascinated to read about the writing process and creating the script and how much thought you put into the entrance of Crash Davis into the story and his first line that we get to see.
Well, I believe that entrances matter in movies, that we remember them, you know, and Nuke has a memorable first entrance in the locker room in flagrante with his pants around his ankles. And, Susan, Annie is narrating the story, I believe, in the Church of Baseball is a memorable opening. And then Crash walks in, world weary, and says, I am the player to be named later. Well, guys don't like to brag about being the player to be named later. But what he said, it was such a world weariness and a wry sense of humor that it's sort of like you realized this is a smart guy because he's using the line kind of against itself. And so that's the three entrances.
Now, Crash's speech that everybody who's seen the movie more than once can recite, I'm sure you've heard it a million times through the years, but you write in the book that you thought it was maybe a little too much, a bit too self-conscious.
Yeah, I still think it's overwritten, and but it works, and everybody loves it, so I'm happy to be wrong. But I thought the writing showed. You try to hide the writing, not show off the writing.
You wanted Costner for the part, and he loved the script, but I thought it was really great that he decided he still had to do a bit of an audition for you.
He did. He said, I love the script, but I don't want to sign on to this until I pass the baseball test with you. Because he said, I played in high school and you, meaning me, played in professionally. So, I mean, there's not an actor in the world that would insist on a tryout after they had the part, except that's typical of Kevin. And so we went out to out here in LA in the San Fernando Valley, there's one of those, every city has one. There's a 3 miniature golf courses, a video arcade, and a batting cage. And we played catch in the parking lot, and nobody knew who he was yet. They walked right by him. Then we got in the cage, and he just started hitting line drives right-handed. And he looked beautiful up there. And he said, I can do the same thing left-handed. And I thought, you're kidding me. So he switched in. I said, Kevin. And I got on the phone and said, hire this guy immediately.
But you almost lost him before you began filming, right?
Well, we had 30 days to get the movie made because his agents had committed to another movie unless we could make ours first. And it came down to hours, even minutes. And it's kind of a thriller part of the book.
It was a real struggle to find someone to play the part of Nuke. As you point out, it couldn't be just a young Crash Davis. They had to be very different characters and actors.
Yeah. If you have a 20-year-old Kevin and a 36-year-old Kevin, why is the woman going to go with the boy? She should go with the man. So it had to be somebody very different physically and just in every way, spiritually. And Tim walked in the door, and he was different than anybody I'd ever seen. I mean, 6'5". He's got that boyish grin. He's sweet. He's smarter than you think. Well, Tim's very smart, but, he was able to give Nuke, dignity and just not play him dumb. You can play him a little dense and uneducated, but he's gaining wisdom. And by the end of the movie, he's teasing Crash. He's, you know, he's throwing the cliches out to the woman sports writer, broadcaster, you know. So he's come a long ways in an hour and 45 minutes.
You didn't know at the time that he had starred in what's considered one of the big flops in Hollywood history, right?
Yeah, I thought it was, I discovered him, and after I was too late to change, it was revealed that his agent and he had failed to mention he was the star of Howard the Duck, which was the biggest bomb in history to that day. And it didn't matter. Kim was great.
You wanted Susan Sarandon. You knew she would be great for the part, but she wasn't on what was known in the industry as the list. Can you explain that?
Well, every studio or financing entity, or today, you know, streaming companies, the Netflixes and HBO Maxes and all those, they have a list of actors and actresses that are there approved for the lead roles. And they call it the list. And the problem is the list changes sometimes every week. And so people fall in and out of favor with the corporation because of a movie that they came out in that didn't do good business, or a bad, I don't know what. The list is mysterious. It was mysterious that Susan wasn't on it, but I won't go into detail because it takes a while, but it's quite entertaining in the book. She flew from Italy, where she was living with her 2-year-old daughter and a nanny on her own dime, to push her way in the door and audition, and she got the part.
And everybody in the cast was so perfect. How did you find Trey Wilson?
Well, Trey had been in, what had he been in? Was he in the Coen Brothers movie, I think? Raising Arizona? I can't remember. He was in something. And he actually was my second choice. A wonderful actor named J.T. Walsh, I thought, was perfect. And Trey was also great, but he was very different. And then J.T. got a bigger offer on another movie, and he had to take the other movie because it was, everybody had bigger offers than our, because we didn't have much money. And so I was delighted to get Trey, who couldn't have been better. So he sadly died of a heart attack a year later. He was on his way to do Miller's Crossing with the Coen Brothers in New Orleans. And I think died on his way to the airport or something. He was very, very sad. He was a young man.
And you mentioned there was an energy in Robert Wall's audition. You saw something there you liked, but the way you used him was terrific, that you tried to wait until a little bit later in the shooting day when the energy had been tamped down a little bit.
Well, Robert is great, and he's you know, he was a stand-up comic, and then he became he was in Good Morning Vietnam and Hollywood Nights and all these movies. And he came in and gave the worst audition in the history of Hollywood. He was so over the top and so energized. It was like you thought he was on speed. He wasn't. That was just normal Robert. It was so bad that when he left the room, the casting director apologized for bringing him in. And I said, hire him. The casting director, who was already wary about a first-time director, said, no, you can't. I said, I know it was the worst audition ever, but what he did, you can't teach. But I can direct it. I can shape it. I can dial it down. I can work with it. He's a baseball lunatic. I mean, he knows more about baseball than anybody. He's in touch with half the GMs in the major leagues. He knows about big trades before they happen. And he's a fabulous professional. And we became friends, and I put him in more movies. So a bad audition isn't the end of the world.
And you would give him the opportunity to try some things out, and it was in that process that he came up with the Candlesticks line.
He did. And that was 4 a.m, where he was starting to get worn down to the rest of us normally. And the end of that scene, he said, I shoot the scripted line, could he have a take with another line? I said, sure. So as I'm shooting the scene, when the cameras are moving around and we're relighting, he would run different lines by me. And about 4 a.m, he said, the Candlesticks line. And I said, don't change a thing. I'll give you a take. We did my line in the script, which was ordinary. And then I did one for Robert. And as soon as he said, Candlesticks always make a nice gift, and find out where she's registered and all that, I knew it was going to be in the movie. And I knew I had an end to that scene, which I was very fond of.
We're talking with Ron Shelton here on Downtown. You believe in the importance of rehearsals. Does that go back to your athletic background?
Very much. Yeah. I mean, you... I think the whole thing is very athletic, making a movie. It's a lot of preparation for, you know, the game. How many thousands of hours goes into preparation for a game that takes a few minutes or an hour, you know? And I think it's the same. I mean, I love audition. You know, Tommy Lee Jones, who I've worked with, calls me coach and calls auditions. I mean, calls rehearsal practice. Coach, let's go get some practice. And I love that idea because it's where you get to try out good ideas, bad ideas. You see what works. When you show up ready to work on the day of shooting, you know the script. You got a couple of fresh ideas saved up. And it's very athletic. The game starts, you know, the first pitch, the tip of the basketball, the kickoff. And now all the preparation is behind you. It's all intuition and talent.
The players had to make the baseball look real, and that's one of the keys to the success of the movie. And one of the guys partially responsible for that, we're up here in Red Sox country, was one-time Red Sox manager Grady Little.
Grady Little, who I quite like, was the manager of the actual Durham Bulls. And by the way, not long before, it was a guy named Brian Snitker.
Yeah.
Who, you know, if he wins one more, he'll be in the Hall of Fame. And so I know Brian. And Grady had just finished the season with the Durham Bulls, you know, which was low A ball at the time. Now it's Triple A, but it was low A. And we said, Grady, we'll pay you a couple more months. Just, we need you to find ball players and run a baseball camp. And we'll put our actors into the camp as well. But we need pitchers ready to throw and fielders and catchers. So he can find like former high school and college guys and also a lot of minor leaguers in the area who had nothing to do for 2 months. So that was all Grady. And then, of course, he goes to the Red Sox, wins 94 games. He goes to the Dodgers, wins 90-something games. He's like averages 90-something games in 4 years, and he's out. And I've always defended him keeping Pedro in, by the way, which I think I do in the book, because he had a weak bullpen. And what people forget is that the hits off of Pedro were cheap, broken bat flares. I mean, he didn't give up line drives. It was just little donks. It was sort of like the famous collapse, you know, in Buckner. Schiraldi and all those guys, Stanley Steamer, they didn't give up rope. They were donks.
What did the addition of Max Patkin do for the film?
Well, I wrote him into the script because I love Max, because I got to know him in the minors. I didn't really know him, but I got to see him a lot. I had a beer with him one night on a rainout, and I just thought he was funny. Most of the players thought he was like corny. I love those physical humor comic guys and vaudeville, really. And so I chased him down and said, "Max, you're going to be in the movie. Show up in Durham." And he was a joy. To let him get a paycheck. And when we had the press junket in L.A., it was at a very fancy hotel where the president stayed in the Century City. And the studio said I could stay in the presidential suite. I said, I live in L.A. I don't need to stay in the hotel. I said, give it to Max Patkin. So we flew Max out. He almost fainted, and he flew his brother out so Max and his brother could stay in the presidential suite during the press junket in L.A.
That's wonderful. You quote John Huston in the book that making a movie is like going to war, and you had your share of battles, and they're well recounted in the book. The studio wanted to replace Tim Robbins. Amazingly, they didn't think Susan Sarandon looked good. And then, worst of all, from my perspective, they hated the meeting at the mound.
Yeah, they didn't think the movie was funny, and they didn't think it was romantic. They didn't think it was sexy. And they said, nobody will believe Susan Sarandon would end up in bed with Tim Robbins, to which I say, I'm the godfather of their firstborn son. So, yeah, the meeting at the mound I loved from the beginning. We edited it quickly and easily. There was never a change. They kept saying it wasn't funny. Now, how do you argue about funny? And so it came down to a screening with the audience. And the audience, every audience picked it as their favorite scene in the movie. So that's why it stayed.
Although, as you talk about in the book, the test audiences reacted and responded to the film, but didn't give it those top scores. But Mike Medavoy decided to, I guess, go with his gut or go with what he saw firsthand and go ahead with the film.
Mike Medavoy was the head of the studio, and So he had some issues while we were shooting it. Once he saw it finished, he totally got behind it. And to this day, I wrote a chapter trying to figure out why we didn't get better test scores. In my business, you want to get 90%, what they call excellent or very good, the top two categories. 80s, you're okay. 70s, you're trying to work them up with edits into the 80s. We never got out of the 50s. And I don't know why. I really don't know why, because once we got in the theater, audiences laughed and cheered. So it's one of the mysteries.
In the script, you have a backstory, a monologue from Annie, kind of explaining how she got to where she was at that point in her life. You eventually had to cut that and let it go. Why was that the right move to make for the film?
Because the movie played better without my favorite scene and everybody's favorite scene. And I'm not sure why. Well, I wrote a whole chapter examining why. I loved the scene. Everybody loved the scene. Susan would have got an Oscar if the scene was in there. But the editor and I determined that for some reason the movie was slowing down for the scene. And I finally came to I believe that there was such intimacy between the two characters, just talking in a bar in the daytime, sharing, that the movie was sort of over before they ended up, in bed together or anything. It was the kind of intimacy that would be shared after you were really getting to know somebody, not before. That was my theory anyway, and I don't have any others, but the movie played better without it.
And then you shifted a key scene late in the film from a brothel to the pool hall, and that seemed to make a big difference.
Yeah, I was an idiot for writing a scene in a brothel in a romantic comedy. I mean, like, come on. But I reshot it in a pool hall. I didn't change a word of dialogue. But now Crash was playing pool, not playing piano in a brothel. So it was quite remarkable that I could reshoot a scene without changing a word of it and just change the location. Right. Made a huge difference. Huge difference.
Do you think if the film had been set in the major leagues, that it would have had the same appeal?
Nope. It wouldn't, because, these guys, it's more interesting to watch guys struggling with their dreams to make it than after they've made it. Now, you can make a movie about a major leaguer, although I don't know what that, I never made it past AAA. But you're dealing with a whole different thing. You're dealing with a corporate world. I mean, it's very corporate, major league sports now. Mm. You're flying on charters to 5-star hotels. There's tremendous pressure, but it's not as much fun.
Well, and you did such a great job of capturing the grittiness, I think what you call the earthiness of the minor leagues, and that sometimes would make the production crew a little bit concerned. The great story, and I'll let people read about it in the book, of the bus with the hat, but ultimately it paid off with a realism that I don't think you would otherwise have.
Right. I did not want the dugouts to be lit like they were on a Hollywood stage. I didn't want the bus to be lit like it was on a Hollywood stage. The minor league parks, the lights were so bad we could hardly get a light meter reading with the camera. We had to clean out the lights and bring in extra lights. But it feels real. When Crash goes out to the mound, it's all handheld. The field in Durham was yellow because it was September, October, November. We have to keep painting it green, and it still looked terrible. The movie looks the way I wanted it to look.
And you write in the book that the movie is ultimately about loving something more than it loves you back. And you don't have to be a baseball fan to be able to relate to that.
Yeah, that I think everybody, any gender or age has loved something, someone, a job, a person, a passion more than they've got it back from that thing. And that's Crash. And I think that's what makes it universal, if anything does.
The book is called The Church of Baseball, The Making of Bull Durham. Home runs, bad calls, crazy fights, big swings, and a hit. I love the movie, and I sure did love reading about everything you went through to make what's become a classic of cinema. Ron Shelton, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rich. My pleasure.
Ron Shelton here on Downtown.